Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams, and he is, of course, our co-host. Daniel, good to see you.
Happy Monday, Dr. Paul.
Oh, very good. You know, this is a special day because we have a special friend.
One of our favorites.
And we've checked out his voting records. Pretty darn good. Yes, it's somebody I've known for a long time, and we're close allies, and that is Jimmy Duncan from the 2nd District of Tennessee. Jimmy, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you, Ron. You were my great leader when we served together in the Congress. I think 16 of the years that I was there, you were also there, and you were my leader. You've been a real hero to me and a man for whom I have the greatest admiration and respect. And I also appreciate the work that Daniel's done over the years. I've watched both of you on YouTube quite a bit, and we think a lot alike.
Well, very good. And, you know, talking about, you know, our close association, I keep wondering whether your association and willingness to work with us might not have helped you. You're not even the chairman of the Transportation Committee. I thought you'd be. Of course, I can't brag about my chairmanship. You had been subcommittee chairman on a couple committees, but right now you haven't been. But if you had set out a goal of being the chairman, how would you have had to act in order to achieve that goal if that was your goal in life rather than doing the right thing?
Well, obviously... Newt Gingrich started a system many years ago of basing committee chairmanships on how much money you raised for the party and whether you were always willing to vote with the leadership. In fact, I remember one time we had a bill up and I heard one of the men standing behind me on the floor saying, well, I would never voted for that bill except that except I'm a chairman and I have to vote for it. And I remember also Mark Sanford, when he came back for his second tour in the Congress, he sat down by me one night and asked how I thought he should vote on this one particular bill. I don't remember what bill it was. And I said, well, I guess if you want to be a chairman of some committee at some point, you'd have to vote for it. And I've always admired the answer he gave. He said, well, I don't need any more merit badges.
Right.
So I have chaired three subcommittees, aviation and highways and transit and water resources, all very significant subcommittees, but I've never really tried to be a chairman of a full committee because my voting card was too important to me.
Right. And Jimmy, you, of course, are on our advisory board of the Institute, which we greatly appreciate. And the war issue has been important to you. You have spoken out very clearly, and you have worked with us, and that's a big issue for us. And we don't all start off with the very same views all our life, but throughout your political career, you had some enlightenment because you haven't always been voting against every single war, and you've been influenced by what went on in Washington. Tell us a little bit about what happened with the first Persian Gulf War and why you are, and one of the reasons why you're so strongly opposed to what they're doing these days.
Well, when I first was elected in 1988, so at the end of this term, I will have spent 30 years in the House. That's a long time. But when I first came, I guess I believed everything that the military-industrial complex said. And when the first Gulf War rolled around in the early 90s, I listened to the briefings by Norman Schwarzkopf and Colin Powell and all the other leadership, and they made Saddam Hussein and his elite troops, they made him sound like the reincarnation of Hitler and how it was a danger to the whole world. And I voted for that first war. But then I noticed that I saw some of those Hussein's elite troops surrendering to CNN camera crews and empty tanks. And I thought then that the threat had been greatly exaggerated. And then we went on down. I was speaking to a group at the Greenbrier one year, and on the front page it had an article about the forgotten war. And this was between the two Gulf Wars and how we were spending $4 million a day dropping bombs on Iraq. And I didn't even really know, you know, most members didn't know anything about it. And then I remember the Washington Post had a front page story where one of our bombs had gone astray and killed seven little boys who were playing soccer in a field in Iraq. And I remember reading about the anguish of a father whose little son, his head had been blown off. And so I started looking at these things much, much closer, and had an interesting meeting at the White House before the second Gulf War. But I can tell you, when the second Gulf War rolled around, I read everything I could get my hands on. And I remember reading a thing in Fortune magazine, and it said, if we went to war in Iraq, we would make American soldiers sitting ducks for Islamic terrorists. And it said, in the article in the U.S. News World Report said, why the rush to war? And so I had real qualms about it. And so then they called me down for a meeting with Condoleezza Rice and George Tenet, the head of the CIA, and John McLaughlin, his second in command. And that was a fascinating meeting.
I think Daniel has a question for you, Jimmy.
Yeah, Mr. Duncan, you know, you're not only a great congressman with a great, very courageous track record on voting, but you're also, and a lot of people know this already, you're an excellent communicator, you're an excellent writer. Some of the articles you've written for the American Conservative and other publications have been so helpful to so many people. And I remember once I was on a panel, I was having to argue against the Iraq war when it was still popular, and all I did was flip open one of your articles about war not being conservative. I just stole most of your points, and it made it easy. But you really have really popularized this idea that war is not a conservative issue.
It's not, and in fact, I wrote an article for the American Conservative magazine, and I said the Republicans, the Republican Party was the peace party at one time, but your viewers might be interested to know about that meeting that I had at the White House with Condoleezza Rice, because when I got down there, they were trying to put pressure on me to vote for the war. And just a day or two before, Lawrence Lindsay, the president's chief of economic advisor, the chairman of his Council for Economic Advisors, said a war with Iraq would cost $200 billion. And I asked about that, and Condoleezza Rice said, oh, no, it wouldn't cost that much. It'd be $50 or $60 billion, and we'd get most of that back from our allies. That had to be the worst estimate in the history of the federal government. And then I asked him, I said, well, if you get past conservatives being the main opponents to world government being the main opponents to massive foreign aid and huge deficit spending, and being the biggest critics of the UN, and you're going to war to enforce UN resolutions, I said, if you get past all those traditional conservative positions, do you have any evidence of any imminent threat? And they didn't. And George Tenet confirmed that in his first speech at Georgetown University the day after he resigned. So, yes, I had serious qualms about it. And then for the first 3 or 4 years after I'd cast that vote, in fact, the night before, one of the television stations in Knoxville had a poll that said 74% were in favor of the war, 9% against, and 17% undecided. And I wondered if I was ending my political career when I cast that vote. But and for 3 or 4 years after that, it was clearly the most unpopular vote I'd ever cast. In fact, I got disinvited from speaking at a Baptist church in Lenore City, Tennessee, a couple of years after I'd done the vote. But slowly, what had been the most unpopular vote, slowly became the most popular vote I ever cast.
Well, that is a great story, because it does prove that if you stick to your principles, you usually win in the end. But you've just cast recently a very important vote with only two other members of the Congress, and so we can't go by popularity on defining right and wrong, because I certainly was with you on this vote, and it had to do with the sanctions, and of course there was a sanctions bill, and then they went back and forth and they made it worse, and there were just three of you that voted against it. Describe to us what goes through your mind about sanctions in relationship to war. Because certainly it is a significant event, and it's ongoing, and things seem to be ratcheting up as a consequence of that vote.
First of all, I read everything I can get my hands on most of these votes that I care about, and I read what you wrote, Dr. Paul, about the sanctions vote. So I had that in my mind, along with some other things that I'd read. But I just thought it was the wrong vote, and for several reasons. For one thing, it included Iran, and our own government had certified twice in the last few months that they were complying with everything that we had demanded in the nuclear arms agreement. And so I didn't think we should slap them in the face just when they're doing everything that we had demanded that they do. And then secondly, it was aimed at Russia. And this Russian obsession of the national media has been ridiculous. I think back about the old Wendy's ad from years ago of Where's the Beef? They've been investigating ever since the day after the election some sort of Russian interference, and even Director Comey said that he had no evidence of any vote that had been altered. But Russia had just helped us in trying to broker a ceasefire in Syria, and they've been helping us in the fight against ISIS and in a lot of other ways. And I just don't want to see a renewal of a big-time Cold War. And also, I said that I think most of the people I represent feel that we should not be, that we have enough problems here at home. We shouldn't be trying to rule the whole world.
Right.
So Daniel, several things.
Right, Daniel.
You know, Mr. Duncan, you're in my mind, and in many minds, you're sort of identified with the Taftian old right. You know, the old anti-war conservatives, real conservative values. When you look around, are you optimistic that this vein might be rekindled, that we might see a rebirth of the anti-war conservative after the neocons have just about destroyed the Republican Party?
No, not really. There's so few of us, but that doesn't mean that I'm not going to keep trying and keep speaking out. You mentioned one article that I'd written, and then I mentioned the article that I wrote about that the Republican Party should be the peace party. And I appreciate the columns that Pat Buchanan writes. He's one of the best, in my opinion. But it's just terrible.
Yeah.
We've created all kinds of animosity all around the world. I've said, you know, we should try to be friends with all countries. And you know what they do? If you vote the way that I vote or speak out the way I've spoken out, you know, the first thing they say, they come at you with that slur about isolationism. And I've said, no, that it's nothing isolationist. I think we should have trade and tourism with all countries, and we should help out during humanitarian crises. And we should have cultural and educational exchanges, all of that. But I think our foreign policy has been totally out of whack. And I will tell you this. I mean, it's almost hurtful in a way to be one of only three. You know, when you get into politics, people who run for office, I think, want to be liked more than most people. And everybody wants to be part of the team. But when we go so far astray, and you know, I'm just opposed to most of what we've been doing, and I was hopeful, and I still am hopeful that President Trump will follow through with a lot of the things he said. Mm-hmm. I was so disappointed by President George W. Bush, because you remember that he said in his campaign that he was opposed to nation building, and that what we needed was a more humble foreign policy. And I'll tell you, when he said those things, I got really excited, because he was singing my tune. But then he went just the opposite way when he got into office, because he was too greatly influenced by the neocons. And George Will wrote a column and said the neocons were probably the most misnamed people that he knew of, because he said they were really the most radical people in this city, meaning Washington.
Jimmy, I want to challenge you a little bit. because you said things look bad, and they do, especially from the Washington viewpoint. But you also said something that I thought was encouraging. You had this real struggle with that first vote, and you even had trouble with the second vote, and you thought it was a disaster and your political career went in. But now you said that your constituency probably, you know, supports the idea that we don't need another war. So I would suggest that you've had an influence with your constituency, and they now are much more aware of the danger. And I think this is where the action is. Your constituency has changed their attitude, and you don't feel the tremendous pressure. But when you deal with Washington, it's a different story. Then you get into this whole definition is how powerful the deep state is. So I would say you're having an effect, and I want to encourage you to continue to do it. Even if you leave office like you're planning on doing, there's still room to promote these ideas, and I think I'm sure you will continue.
Well, I appreciate that, and I guess I shouldn't be totally pessimistic because in one of those articles I wrote for the American Conservative, I told about speaking to the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce in a meeting that they had in Washington, and this was in front of about 200 top executives from the Los Angeles area, a very upper income group, and spoke at the Willard Hotel. And when I reached a point in my speech and said that we need to stop trying to run the whole world, and we need to start putting our own people and our own country first once again. And they interrupted me with applause. And that was unexpected from that group. But I knew middle income people and lower income people pretty much felt that way. But I was surprised that even that group. And so, you know, those things, I was saying those things long before President Trump started saying some of those things too.
Right. Daniel?
Well, Dr. Paul did mention an unhappy occasion that this will be your last term. You've announced it about a week or so ago. Have you started making some plans about what your next chapter is going to be? Do you have some articles planned, or what's on the agenda?
Well, I want to do a lot of things, but I just started adding up all the time that I'd spend in airports and airplanes and driving around my district, and it has to be several years of my life, and I have one of the greatest blessings in the world in that I have 9 grandchildren all here in Knoxville, in my hometown. I know the media is sometimes skeptical, and probably rightly so, when a political figure says he wants to spend more time with his family. But in my case, it's really true. And but I've not used the word retire. There's a law school here for Lincoln Memorial University that they were nice enough a few years ago to name after me. I may teach a course at the law school. I want to do some writing that I've done for Chronicles and the American Conservative and many other publications. I want to do some of that, but I want to. I'll keep speaking out, but I just won't be running for office, at least in the near future, I don't think.
And Jimmy, we'll keep reminding you about the Institute for Peace and Prosperity. You're already on that board, and I'm sure you will continue to contribute, and we're looking forward to that. But we want to thank you very much for being with us today. I know our audience will be very pleased with this interview and to know what kind of work you've been doing. I'm sure most of them know it. But not only have you been really energetic and supportive of this anti-war position, when it comes to the average conservative spending position, you are a real tiger on cutting spending. So this country and Washington is going to really miss you. But believe me, the fight is just as much outside of Washington as it is in Washington. I keep telling myself, and it might be just pumping it up, that don't judge the world by what's happening in Washington. That is so artificial, and that can come to an end, especially because I anticipate that this foreign policy will fail as well as our economic system, and we will have revamping. And that's why what you do and continue to do to change people's minds, I think that's the most important. But, Jimmy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Dr. Paul, and I'm so proud of you and so grateful for you, and thank you for having me on this program today.
Thank you. And then I want to thank our audience today for joining us. And please come back to the Liberty Report soon.